Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 30559, State v. Pitts, arguing for the petitioner, Kevin O'Grady, arguing for the respondent, Sonia McCullen, argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. O'Grady and Ms. McCullen. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. Mr. O'Grady, you've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a yellow light will come on with 10 minutes to go in your argument, and then Ms. McCullen will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go in your 30-minute argument, if that's agreeable. All right, please proceed, Mr. O'Grady. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the right to counsel at post-trial is a critical stage under the Sixth Amendment, and as such is applicable to a plain error analysis under Hawaii state law. The right to counsel is an important and fundamental right, and that right for Mr. Pitts was completely denied to him for the relevant time period as raised in the question presented, that is, after the verdict and before the appointment of appellate counsel some 100-some-odd days later. The right to counsel is one of the rights that is so basic that its complete denial is structural, such that reversal is warranted. I believe this comports with Hawaii state law as it pertains to plain error. The plain error here was that despite the fact that Mr. Pitts had repeatedly requested counsel be reappointed, that the court decided that he would not get that counsel. When they came back for post-trial motions, the circuit court said to Mr. Pitts that he was not going to get counsel at that time and that it was sure that he would get appellate counsel later on in the future. And in fact, that did occur some 100 plus some odd days later. In the intervening time period, however, from the time of verdict through, I believe, two different court dates, one in April and one in May, before the appointment of appellate counsel, Mr. Pitts was without any court-appointed counsel whatsoever. This court recently, in Kramer, decided that the right to counsel even extends to the right of counsel of choice for privately obtained counsel. Here, we are addressing the right of an indigent defendant and his right to court-appointed counsel during a critical stage of the proceedings. There's also Hawaii-specific case law that says that other times after the verdict are critical stages such that appointment of counsel is appropriate. There is a case regarding the minimum term hearing with the paroling authority. That is also...
Does the record reflect whether or not Mr. Pitts did have counsel during his minimum term hearing, if any?
I believe that was me, Your Honor, and yes, he did have counsel at his minimum term hearing.
Okay. But not for sentencing and not for the post-trial motion for new trial?
That's correct, Justice McKenna. As framed by the question before the court today, the time period is after verdict and before the appointment of appellate counsel, specifically for sentencing and post-trial, post-verdict motions. I believe there were two hearings, one in April and one in May, where Mr. Pitts stood alone.
Were there any options for sentencing for Mr. Pitts?
No. It's my understanding from a review of the transcripts, Justice McKenna, that because of what Mr. Pitts was convicted of, there were no options. And I believe Judge Kim made that much clear to Mr. Pitts at the time, either on April the 7th or May the 12th, during the sentencing. But
The sentencing hearing serves other purposes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Justice Kova.
At the sentencing hearing, if there were any problems with the pre-sentence report, then you would think counsel, if he was present or she was present, would object or place something on the record.
Yes, Justice Kova. And that brings me to my other point, which is, in this particular case, because the denial of counsel was complete at those particular stages, that is the April 7th, and May 12th hearing, and for the relevant time period as presented by the court, you cannot go back, and it is not amenable to a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis, because it is, as you pointed out, Justice Acoba, sentencing in this particular case, although mandated in a particular way by statute, there are other things that counsel could have done there. Although you've pointed out that the pre-sentence report might be an area in which counsel might be able to make argument or corrections. Additionally, this court asked about post-trial motions, and Mr. Pitts had attempted to file some post-trial motions, and in fact, his standby counsel also attempted to file some post-trial motions. Judge,
not attempted, he did.
No, he did. That's true. But
within a week.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, just to follow up. But those were done without the benefit of counsel, and so I think.
Well, it looks like Mr. Shum had assumed the mantle of being counsel, or because he filed the motion.
Well, Justice Pollack, Mr. Shum did in fact file some motions, but later Judge Kim indicated that his ability and his authority and his standing to be able to represent or defend Mr. Pitts had ceased once the verdict was read. Judge Kim made that clear after the verdict was read. I do not get the impression from the transcript that it was abundantly clear for Mr. Shum at the time the verdict was read, but Judge Kim made it very clear later on the April 7th hearing that Mr. Shum had no standing to file the particular motion. And Mr. Pitts did file his own motions.
The next day?
Yes.
So he was freely able to file a motion if he wanted to earlier.
That's true, he was able to file one. But just because, Justice Pollack, just because one is able to file one does not necessarily mean that one has the benefit of counsel. I think that the cases, I believe it's either Marshall or Charles versus California, indicate that during the relevant time periods where one does not have counsel, one does not necessarily, just because one is able to file motions, that does not mean that one has the benefit of counsel. And in fact, this case, Mr. Shum was completely relieved of his duties following the reading of the verdict.
Mr. O'Grady, how do you respond to the state's argument in citation to Rogers that the request has to be timely?
Your Honor, I respond as follows. Mr. Pitts had requested continually during the ending part of his trial that he requested reappointment of counsel. When he was then able to see Judge Kim again on the 7th, he additionally requested it. I think in the Rogers case, there's language where it says that the defendant had requested counsel. And in that particular case, I think the court had indicated that it says that Rogers also requested the reappointment of a defense panel attorney. And later on, it says the trial court denied his motion. There is language in there that that particular defendant filed both a motion, which I think was called a Mar motion in under California law for the appointment of new counsel, but he also made a request. I think that the appointment of counsel is so fundamental that this court should find that a defendant need not necessarily file a particular motion if he has otherwise indicated his request to reassert his right after a valid Faretta waiver.
Is Judge Kim required? Was Judge Kim required to appoint him new counsel after he'd already gone through four of them?
Your Honor, Justice Pollack, while Mr. Pitts had provided a waiver and the Intermediate Court of Appeals had determined that that waiver was valid under Faretta, I believe the case law indicates that this is a new stage of the trial. So while, and this court has not asked about the time period up to verdict, so if we assume that his waiver during trial carried through up until verdict, even Judge Kim recognized on April the 7th and May the 12th that you were going to get your new attorney, is what Judge Kim said. So he recognized that this was a new stage. It was not going to be disruptive as it would be during the last minute just before closing arguments when Mr. Pitts had requested trial again. The judge, Judge Kim, could say, well, at this point, you've been through four attorneys already. You're reversing course again, language from Marshall and Charles versus California. You're reversing course at the last minute here at trial, so Judge Kim exercised his discretion and said, I'm not going to appoint counsel now. That was up until verdict. But Judge Kim recognized after trial, this was now a new setting. This is post-trial motions. And Judge Kim said, you will get your attorney. The problem is that Judge Kim held his Faretto waiver through the post-trial motion time period and sentencing and did not give him an attorney until his appellate counsel was appointed 134 days later.
My question is a little bit different, and I appreciate what you're saying. I'm not sure I understand what the distinction Judge Kim made between the post-verdict period and the appellate period. In other words, why your client was entitled to a new lawyer on appeal and not post-trial. But nevertheless, what standard was Judge Kim, I mean, is it absolute? Are you saying that a person has an absolute right to change their mind and have counsel appointed?
I think, Your Honor, that if you look at the critical stages, and it is difficult, Justice Pollack, in some cases to define different parts of a trial. There could be, for example, the last witness versus closing argument versus verdict. But if you look at it in bigger chunks and you have the trial, a separate critical stage is post-trial. A separate critical stage after that would be minimum term hearing, because the minimum term hearing does not necessarily coincide with that 10 to 30 days after the verdict when post-trial motions are due and when sentencing is occurring. This court has already determined that a minimum term hearing requires appointment of counsel. That's a separate critical stage. And it could be that that person had waived counsel at trial. It does not necessarily mean that the Faretto waiver continues on forever.
Well, would you agree that there could be situations in which a court, trial court, could find that there was bad faith even in the post-trial context? And if so, based on the number of prior waivers, other circumstances that might exist, or is it an absolute right to reassert the right to counsel post-trial? Is it an absolute right, or could a trial court, could there be situations where, I don't know, maybe we're up to our 10th lawyer, or there could be some other circumstances? Would you agree there could be some other circumstances, and if so, why or would this defendant, Mr. Pitts, fall within that rule or not, in your view?
It's an excellent question, Mr. Chief Justice. I think that in order to get to the answer, first we have to determine, is this a new and separate critical stage? And I think the case law is, yes, it is. Post-trial and sentencing is a separate and critical stage beyond the verdict. Are there circumstances where a particular defendant, or this particular defendant, Mr. Pitts, could have been deemed to have waived again? The example you gave, Mr. Chief Justice, was bad faith. Yes, that is, of course, possible. No right is absolute. However, I think it would be incumbent upon Judge Kim at that particular time to conduct a new analysis under Faretta to determine whether or not bad faith exists. And in this particular case, I don't think that's present because Mr. Pitts, although he had been through a number of attorneys and had filed motions on his own, by the time the case was coming to a close before verdict, he was steadfast in his continued request for an attorney. And when they resumed on in April, Mr. Pitts again requested an attorney, and he wasn't waiting until the last minute. I don't know that he necessarily knew to file for a motion. I don't see in the record any motions for a new attorney. He just filed all the substantive motions. Every time he wanted a new attorney, he merely asked for one.
Mr. O'Grady, the briefs weren't that clear, but was it a fact that Mr. Shum either filed or prepared the motion for a new trial, but that the judge prevented Mr. Shum from arguing that motion and required Mr. Pitts to do that?
Justice Koba, I agree that I'm a little confused by what transpired on the, I believe it was April the 7th. I believe what is clear is that Judge Kim indicated that Mr. Shum did not have standing to file those things that he did file, and that Judge Kim also interpreted the filings from Mr. Shum and also Mr. Pitts to have been timely enough so that Judge Kim would listen to those motions. I believe there's also language in the transcript where Judge Kim indicated that although Mr. Pitts was referring to it as a motion for a new trial, Judge Kim was interpreting it as something else. And he said, no, you didn't file a notice of appeal, you filed a motion for trial.
The briefs also differ because one says that Mr. Pitts made his request for an attorney in the middle of trial, and I think your brief says, or someone says, the last day of trial. Do you know when his request for an attorney was made?
After the waiver?
Yeah.
After the waiver? I don't remember exactly, but it was before closing arguments, because I know that I remember in the transcripts that Mr. Pitts had requested an attorney, and Judge Kim had made a determination that he was not going to, we weren't going to go through this again, I think was Judge Kim's language, because he had already conducted the waiver, and at that time, I think there was still a question from Mr. Shum as to whether or not he could resume based upon some allegations from Mr. Pitts. I have to admit, it was very, there's a lot of material in there, and it was very, it's hard for me to remember it all.
Mr. O'Grady, what is your position on behalf of the defendant of what the trial court should have done here?
What the trial court should have done.
When and what?
Yes. Mr. Chief Justice, I think that because Mr. Pitts had requested counsel and the court had determined that a valid Faretta waiver continued until verdict, but Judge Kim knew that Mr. Pitts wanted counsel again, that while the case was proceeding to verdict, he should have initiated those steps such that Mr. Pitts could have had counsel appointed to him following the verdict. Because Mr. Pitts was clearly asking for reappointment of counsel. Now, whether or not it was Mr. Shum is a separate question. There's sort of a love-hate relationship evident in the transcript where he's alleging that Mr. Shum is selling him out and he's prepared to file ODC complaint, and then he wants Mr. Shum back again.
Mr. Shum raised the issue that he, Mr. Pitts, indicated he would report him to ODC. So I assume at that point, the briefs indicate the judge declined to reappoint or reinstate Mr. Shum as Pitts's attorney. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, but at a point subsequent to that, apparently Mr. Shum indicated he would serve as counsel?
If I remember correctly, I think so. I know Mr. Pitts was asking for reappointment of counsel later on in the trial.
Do you know when that was during the trial?
I do not have that information off the top of my head, Justice Kova. I do not. I just remember that Mr. Pitts had asked again for the reappointment of counsel, and that Judge Kim, going back to your question, Mr. Chief Justice, Judge Kim should have initiated those procedures to get another counsel. And if Judge Kim was wary because of the back and forth between Mr. Shum and Mr. Pitts and the allegations that Mr. Pitts had or would file an ODC complaint against Mr. Shum, that Judge Kim should have initiated a new counsel, especially in light of the fact that this is a complicated attempted murder case and it would take time for that counsel to get up to speed and to speak to Mr. Shum and or Mr. Pitts.
Well, your client asked for new counsel, didn't he, within a week after the verdict?
Within a week after the verdict, in writing, Justice Pollack?
Yes, there's the motion by Mr. Shum is titled Motion to Withdraw Standby Counsel, Appoint Substitute Counsel, and Declare Mistrial. And in paragraph 18, it says, I discussed the matter with Mr. Pitts. He agreed with me filing this motion so the rights were preserved, and he could possibly have counsel appointed that could represent him.
That's what Mr. Shum filed.
Represented. So Mr. Shum at that point was either serving, either there had been acceptance of counsel or he was serving still as standby counsel. In any event, there's a request made within a week.
Yes, Justice Pollack, by Mr. Shum, not by Mr. Pitts. I don't think Mr. Pitts filed his, I don't remember Mr. Pitts filing his own motion.
I understand that.
Okay.
I'm just saying that the information had been transmitted to the court.
Yes.
Regarding Mr. Pitts' request.
Yes, that did occur, and Judge Kim addressed that, Justice Pollack, by saying, I don't think that there's a need for you to withdraw because your duties ended at the reading of the verdict. So that again indicates, Mr. Chief Justice, that Judge Kim recognized that although the Faretta waiver was still applying to verdict, once the verdict was complete, Pitts was without counsel. Pitts had requested counsel. And as evidenced, Justice Pollack, by what Mr. Shum had submitted shortly after the verdict, Mr. Shum represented to the court that Mr. Pitts also indicated that he wanted counsel, even though Mr. Pitts did not file his own motion requesting counsel. And I think on April 7th that might have arisen. the discussion between Judge Kim and Mr. Pitts as to whether or not Mr. Pitts had filed anything in particular. But you're right, Justice Pollack. Mr. Shum had requested that he be withdrawn, and that seems to add to the confusion because, again, Judge Kim indicates that from the reading of the verdict, Mr. Shum was off the case. But Mr. Shum must have thought he was still on because he needed to be substituted. He needed to withdraw and to provide substitute counsel.
And Mr. O'Grady?
Yes.
Judge Kim had decided to continue the sentencings and address the motions to another date, would that have prejudiced the state at all?
If I may answer your question, Your Honor, because I noticed that my light is on here. But would it have prejudiced the defendant or the state?
The state.
The state. I don't think so, Your Honor, because the defendant had been in custody already for some time. I don't know how it could have prejudiced the state by delaying that.
Did they bring any witnesses or put on any evidence?
For the sentencing? I'm sorry, I don't remember at the sentencing. I was focusing on the post-trial motions, which occur on April the 7th, which was afterwards. I think the sentencing was continued after that.
Well, the post-trial motions also, because he had requested counsel for the post-trial motions.
Yes.
Would that have prejudiced the state in any way?
I don't think it would have prejudiced the state at all. And if I may reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. McCullen, your argument.
Good morning, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Based on this court's questions to defendant, it appears that this court is concerned with the circuit court's denial of defendant's request for an attorney or request for a reappointment of an attorney post-verdict. In my supplemental brief, I cited a Ninth Circuit case, but inadvertently overlooked that it was recently reversed by a United States Supreme Court in April of this year. In its opinion, the United States Supreme Court held that the California's totality of circumstances approach could be also applied, or the approach that they used mid-trial could also be applied post-verdict. And so that gives this court some examples, I guess, or some guidance as to different approaches to use, one being the totality of circumstances and one being the Ninth Circuit, sufficient reason, timeliness and sufficient reason. Under either circumstances, though, the state believes that it meets either approach.
Did the court apply either approach? It looked like to me it didn't apply a totality of circumstances or a presumption standard under the Ninth Circuit. It denied it absolutely and said there was no, it didn't have to apply any standard.
You're correct to a certain extent. There is no binding precedent on this in this jurisdiction for the court to apply. There's no binding approach for this court to apply. And the circuit court, I think, did the best it could with the circumstances it had. And what the court did do was look at the timeliness of defendant's request, and the court also looked at defendant's reasons for his request, one being that he felt he couldn't do it by himself, but if you look at the record before us, defendant was doing it by himself. He was conducting and actively litigating his case. Defendant also posited as a reason that the waiver was invalid. And again, that the waiver was found to be valid. The court conducted an extensive colloquy. The defendant, when asked if he's still willing to or wanting to invoke his right to self-representation, the defendant said absolutely.
What's your response to Mr. O'Grady's argument that things change once the trial has come to a conclusion, that at that point there needs to be some additional inquiry or additional action by the trial court because the defendant's circumstances have now changed. He or she has been convicted and perhaps is now has very real-world evidence that their attempts of self-representation were unsuccessful and may well at that point want to reassess their waiver. Is there no duty by the court to, at that point, revisit the issue?
Yes, and I think the court did revisit it. The court listened to the defendant's request and gave reasons for denying it. And the distinction, I don't think, is as bright as defendant is arguing, because when a defendant is appointed counsel, that appointment doesn't just end at verdict. The appointment goes through and through the next phases.
So would you agree with Judge Kim that Attorney Shum was done by operation of law or by operation of some other principle as standby counsel as soon as the verdict was over? Or did he have some ongoing duty in the case, in your view? It sounded like you just were suggesting he did have an ongoing role to play.
Well, I think Judge Kim explained during trial that Mr. Shum's duties or as standby counsel was during trial. And Judge Kim obviously interpreted that as ending at the verdict. Is there a law to as a basis for that? Nothing that I could find. But
normally, though, when you are appointed as court counsel, that appointment takes you throughout the entire case, doesn't it?
Correct.
Up and through sentencing, because it otherwise wouldn't make much sense to end an appointment at the verdict and then leave the defendant without counsel. So in terms of what the brief said, they said that Mr. Pitts was frustrated in his cross-examination of Mr. Brown, and it was at that point that he requested that counsel be appointed for him. So is it at that point that Judge Kim had the opportunity to either appoint new counsel or reinstate Mr. Shum as counsel?
Yes, Judge Kim did have the opportunity to do so, and he questioned the parties. He asked the defendant why, what were his reasons. The defendant said he was irritated, he was overwhelmed. Defendant also expressed frustration with the
I'm sorry, is it at that point that is that at that point that Mr. Shum raised the disciplinary counsel issue?
Yes.
Okay. So that at that point the judge denied the request.
Yes.
For new counsel. Now, what was the next point at which Mr. Pitts requested new counsel after that?
Mr. Pitts himself, he filed a motion for a counsel for sentencing and appeal. I believe that was on April 19th. And then...
That was after the verdict?
Yes, correct.
Before the verdict, did he request counsel again?
No.
Did Mr. Shum request counsel on his behalf before the verdict?
No.
But after the verdict on March 17th, Mr. Shum filed the motion for appointment of substitute counsel and mistrial, which actually was a motion for new trial.
Correct.
And in his motion, he said that Mr. Pitts had asked him to assist him in requesting a new trial. And he told Mr. Pitts that he was unable to continue his representation because of the ethical implications that had been raised, but that he would speak with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel about whether it would be proper for him to file a motion to withdraw and to move for mistrial based on Mr. Pitts's decision to proceed pro se. And that the Office of Disciplinary Counsel advised Mr. Shum that it would be permissible for him to file the motion that he did file so long as the defendant agreed so that his full rights, both post-trial and on appeal, would be preserved. In other words, Mr. Shum was authorized by ODC to file the motion to appoint substitute counsel as long as Mr. Pitts' post-trial rights were actually preserved. And actually, based on what has happened here, is it the state's position that this happened, that Mr. Pitts's post-trial rights to counsel were preserved?
Are you asking me if Mr. Shum's motion preserved Mr. Pitts'
Do you think that the trial court's, is it the state's position that the trial court's denial of Mr. Shum's request for appointment of substitute counsel preserved Mr. Pitts' rights to counsel? Let me just ask you this question. Is it the state's position that a motion for new trial is a critical stage of proceedings or not?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Was the motion for new trial brought timely? If it was filed on April 7th? You have to bring it within 10 days of the verdict?
Correct. What happened was Mr. Shum's motion was timely. And during the hearing of Mr. Shum's motion, the court, I guess in its discretion, allowed Mr. Pitts an additional 10 days. Because Mr. Shum's motion was timely, he, as a courtesy, allowed Mr. Pitts 10 additional days.
Did the court have the power to do that?
According to Rule 33, apparently no.
It's Rule 45, actually.
Rule 45, actually.
Oh, sorry, Rule 45.
45 plus 33. 45 says you could only, not able, or in essence, read together the rules, say the court lacked the power to do that. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. What about, let's break it down with regard to sentencing and appeal. Is it the state's position? With regard to sentencing, again, when we went to the April 7th hearing, there was a discussion between the court and Mr. Pitts about the appointment of counsel. It kind of got into appeal, got into sentencing, and Mr. Pitts, in fact, filed a written motion for appointment of counsel for sentencing, which was denied at the time of sentencing, and he was sentenced without counsel. Is the state's position that was without error, or there was no error in what the court did, and if so, why wouldn't there have been error?
Yes, the state's position is that it wasn't erroneous. The court in the sentencing portion, right?
Let's start with sentence. I'll get to the motions in a minute.
Okay. As for sentencing,
so written request for clear oral request on April 7th. Clear a motion. I need an attorney. I can't do this on my own. Quite clearly stated, both verbally and now in a written motion, I think on the 19th of April. Then we get to sentencing, and I can't recall if it was restated. Actually, I think in general at the start of the sentencing, Mr. Pitts said, I like an attorney. I can't do this by myself. I really need an attorney. So now we have.
I think that was in regards to the post-motion verdicts.
It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, the court responds, I'm not going to give you an attorney for your sentencing today nor for these motions. So the court apparently read it as a broad request. So three requests by the defendant now either orally or in writing over the course of about a month. Is it the state's position that there's not a right to counsel at sentencing? Or what would be the state's basis for finding no error here?
The state's position is that there was no error, and in looking at the entire record, defendant's conduct demonstrated that he wasn't willing to work with any attorney. He was on his fourth attorney, and he was asked, or he had fired his fourth
attorney. That's your conclusion.
And he was asking,
isn't that your conclusion? The court never says that.
The court never says that, but I think the record demonstrates that his conduct and his interactions with each attorney he was assigned was that he wasn't going to work with them. He didn't communicate with them. He blatantly lied to them, according to the attorneys who represented him. He threatened ODC reporting. He also
Then why was he entitled to counsel for sentencing or for appeal?
I'm sorry?
Then why would he be entitled to counsel for an appeal then, if he clearly waived his right to counsel all the way down the line?
Well, I think it's within the discretion of the court, and the court at the time apparently looked at the record, and considering the record, perhaps at this point in time in sentencing, in which he has no discretion in the sentence imposed, thought that having a fifth attorney might only cause delay because he hasn't shown that he can.
The court didn't say that.
No, the court didn't.
In fact, the court had actually said something like, "Well, you know, I got a mandatory sentence here of life with parole, so frankly, an attorney's not going to, you know, may not be all that relevant."
Correct.
Okay, is that a legitimate reason for granting or denying an attorney?
Well, we don't have a. Is
it the state's position there's no right to counsel in any sentencing where there's a mandatory sentence? No right to counsel.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
So
to the extent we read what Judge Kim said to suggest that would be error, if that's how we read what his comment was.
I'm sorry.
Judge Kim's comment, I think it was on the 8th, on the 7th, was something to the effect of, you know, it's not going to, now you can file the motion, you can try if you want to, although it's not as if an attorney would help you very much. Now, is that, assuming we read that as a statement that, you know what, this is just not a very important thing to have an attorney at a sentencing when the sentence is predetermined, that would be error if we read it that way. And I understand we might read it a different way, we might read it differently in context, but the state does not argue that there's no right to counsel at sentencing just because there's a predetermined sentence or a sentence that's mandated by law.
Yeah, just because there's no discretion in imposing a sentence doesn't mean you have no right to an attorney. The defendant does have a Sixth Amendment right to attorney, but in this case, he waived that right and invoked his right to self-representation.
Under which test? Are you saying we should apply the California test, or are you applying the Ninth Circuit bad faith test?
I think as to the sentencing, I think under either test.
Not just sentencing, but the post-trial motions. What test is the state advocating that we apply?
The state would prefer the totality of circumstances.
The California test.
Yes.
Was there anything that precluded pro se counsel, but standby counsel from filing that motion?
Well, that almost enters into the realm of a hybrid representation, because you still have the defendant who had invoked his right to self-representation. He was actively litigating his case, and to have another person be filing in addition to defendant's filings, and have another person be arguing in addition to defendant's arguments, that could cause confusion. And the court does have inherent power to manage the proceedings before it. And I think it's within the court's discretion to say, no, we're going to just have one person do the filing. And right now, it's the defendant who's representing himself, and he should be doing the filing.
Is there anything in the record that reflects he directed standby counsel not to file anything on his behalf?
No, there isn't.
I'm sorry, just coming back to the appeal, it's the state's position that there was a prior waiver and that waiver was still effective. That's why, even though Mr. Pitts had said on three different occasions in writing or orally that he wanted an attorney for sentencing, that he was bound by that prior waiver?
Yes.
Because of circumstances of, because why?
Well, he waived his right to counsel. He invoked his right to self-representation. He's been representing himself. And at the point of Mr. Shum's filing, the court apparently felt Mr. Shum didn't have standing to file. And I don't think that was erroneous.
But that day, Mr. Pitts appeared before the court and raised the question of appointment of counsel. I think he expressed a desire.
I think they discussed only towards appeal, not necessarily for sentencing or post-verdict.
I think it wandered into sentencing. I have a quote here, and it's Mr. Pitts, so I can't file for an appointed attorney for my sentencing. And the court said, no, I'm not saying you can't file. I'm just saying that, you know, I will consider whatever you file within reason. Again, I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure that an attorney would help you very much. And then Mr. Pitts, in fact, does file a couple days later, I think, well, 2 weeks later.
You're correct. It wandered into that, but Mr. Pitts never made a request at that point for an attorney.
So
they discussed it. I mean, they discussed what he could file.
So did the court, in effect, terminate Mr. Shum at the time of verdict?
It sounds like that's what the court was.
So after verdict, Mr. Shum was no longer standby counsel.
That's what it sounds like.
So he appeared, but he had no status, standby or otherwise.
That's what The circuit court was interpreting it as, yes.
Would that be a proper exercise of the court's discretion to say that, to appoint Mr. Shum as standby counsel, and at the end of the verdict say, you are terminated as standby counsel?
Again, there's not a case law to guide us here with that. And was it within the court's discretion? Yes, I think so. Especially if standby counsel is attempting to file documents in addition to...
Did the court give any reasons for terminating Mr. Shum at the end of the verdict?
It just said his responsibilities ended at verdict.
Well, what if Mr. Shum agreed to represent Mr. Pitts pro se? I mean, you know, without any compensation. I mean, what about the right of a defendant to choose his attorney?
Well, Mr. Shum actually filed a motion to withdraw, so I don't think he was willing to
But he also then, subsequently, he also then filed, despite that, he did file another supplemental memorandum, right, trying to support Mr. Pitts. He filed May 12th, he filed a supplemental memo regarding pro se defendant's motion for new trial.
Correct. He filed a supplemental memo.
At the hearing on May 12th, the court reiterated that Shum has nothing to do with Pitt's case at this point. He's pro se, he's waived counsel. And Mr. Pitts insisted, I would like an attorney. I can't do this by myself. I really need an attorney. And the circuit court responded, I'm not going to give you an attorney for your sentencing today, nor for these motions. You filed them pro se. You've been pro se.
Well, the court is correct. The defendant waived his right to counsel. And prior to that, the defendant went through four attorneys.
Once a waiver, always a waiver.
No, not necessarily. I think in this particular in this case, with these particular circumstances, defendant hasn't been working with the attorneys he's been given.
But that's not the reason Judge Kim gave, correct?
That's not the reason, but this court can affirm for other reasons.
But what reasons are there? There's no reason stated. There's no exercise of discretion whatsoever. Judge Kim essentially came to the conclusion that since he had waived counsel, that was it until appeal.
Well, I think Judge Kim was trying to make him understand his position at that point. But Judge Kim also gave other reasons, such as he didn't feel that a request for attorney at sentencing was made timely.
Well, you're not going to argue that that's correct, that a counsel at sentencing wouldn't be helpful because it's a mandatory sentencing. You're not going to make that argument, are you?
Well, I'm saying that was one of Judge Kim's reasons. He didn't just rely on the waiver.
Sentencing was May 12th.
And
the motion, Mr. Shim's motion to appoint substitute counsel was March 17th, 2 months before?
Correct. Mr. Shim's motion.
7 days after the verdict?
Correct.
And Mr. Pitts's written motion for appointment of counsel for sentencing was April 19th, correct?
Correct.
And how is it then that it was his request was untimely with regard to counsel for sentencing? And I didn't see Judge Kim say that on the 12th, by the way. I just see Judge Kim saying...
Oh, that was on the 7th. He informed the defendant that you can file what you want, but you had a lot of time to file already, and it's too late or something to that effect. Or it would be considered late, something to that effect.
Well, I think he was talking about the substantive motions. I think Judge Kim realized there was an issue by the time Mr. Shum's motion was before the court, the 10 days had expired. To file anything. So now we're in a situation where by the time the motion is before the court and the court is saying, Mr. Pitts, this gentleman over here, Mr. Shum, has nothing to do with this case. He has no standing whatsoever, in essence. The problem that created for the court and for Mr. Pitts, I guess, was that the 10 days to file a motion for new trial had expired. So it was not my understanding of what the court was trying to do was to preserve for Mr. Pitts the ability to be able to file something.
On April 7th?
Yes.
Yes, he gave Mr. Pitts 10 more days, but I recall when it came to discussion about sentencing, the court informed him that he had plenty of time to have done it, and he didn't.
Why would it be untimely? What's the deadline? Why would there be anything wrong with a defendant concluding by April 7th, when the sentencing is not till May 12th, that based on everything that's going on, the defendant has realized that, gosh, I'm in a whole lot of trouble. I'd better have a lawyer for sentencing. Is there a rule that says that?
There's no rule that says that. And like I mentioned earlier, there's no binding precedent for the circuit courts who have followed at the time. And it was exercising its discretion and, I guess, doing the best it could with what it had.
I'm going to read you something from the April 7th hearing. And you're going to have to persuade me that now you want an attorney. You don't want to go pro se anymore, and you want an attorney to help you with your appeal, because that's all that's going to be left now, is basically your appeal, because I'm not giving you an attorney, because I don't have a motion in front of me now, and I am not going to appoint you an attorney, even if I wanted to represent you at your sentencing, for example.
And I think didn't they discuss the filing a motion for sentencing after that?
But there was a motion on file as of
there
March
was.
17th for substitute counsel.
By Mr. Chu?
Yes.
And by Mr. Pitts then after the hearing.
Correct,
so,
there was.
Okay, I don't have the court's response on April 7th was, well, I don't have a motion in front of me, and I'm not going to give you a lawyer even if I wanted to for sentencing. And so Mr. Pitts goes, well, wait a minute. You said I can't even file? That's what he said. I can't file for an appointed attorney for sentencing. And the court says, well, I'm not telling you I've already made up my mind yet. You can file whatever you want. But noted again, I don't have any discretion at your sentencing. So it's what he said. It's not as though even if you're represented at your sentencing, an attorney would help you very much. So the court is kind of suggesting, well, I'm not sure it's all that important a thing, but yeah, you can file the motion. And then he filed the motion. Mr. Pitts filed the motion about, I guess it was 10 days later, on
correct.
The 19th.
Yes.
So how is that motion untimely?
Well, it was, there is no time frame established in law. It's just that that's one of the, factors the court considered. And apparently the court felt that a motion should be should have been done sooner. But besides timeliness, there's also, if you're looking at the totality of circumstances, there's defendants, the reasons for defendants' request to look at. There's also defendants' conduct and the history of substitution of counsel to look at. And the fact that defendant had actively litigated his case throughout the trial. All those factors can be considered in
So in terms of the California test, then one of the, if we were to adopt the California test, one of the factors is the quality of the defendant's self-representation. What is the state's position as to the defendant's, the quality of the defendant's self-representation during trial?
The defendant was actively litigating his case. He filed numerous motions. He requested discovery. He made legal arguments. He cross-examined witnesses. He was intent on it. It appears from the record to litigate his case, and he was doing a good job at it. Apparently, because the circuit court said, "You're doing a hell of a job. You could have been a hell of a trial attorney." The court also said, "You're a smart fella." The court also said, "That's one of the best closings I've heard." So from the record, it looks like he was doing his job. He was defending himself. Okay. I see my light's on. If there's any further questions.
What about with regard to the motions? Now, I think, you know, I've been asking a lot of questions about the sentencing. My understanding is the state has also had a timeliness concern about the request of Mr. Pitts for counsel to be appointed with regard to his motions. And if I understood that argument, it's that in the state's view, that request wasn't unequivocally made till the day of the hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what was it not apparent, for example, from Shum's motion back on the 17th that Mr. Pitts, in fact, wanted counsel to help him in all aspects of the case at that point?
If we in part Mr. Shum's motion, and that he had, I guess, the ability or the standing to file the motion, then it could be imparted onto Mr. Pitts. That would be a reasonable interpretation. But, like I said, timeliness, that's not the only criteria. We can look at the whether the defendant has, or whether there was sufficient, or whether the court had sufficient reason to deny it. And I think in this case, the court did have sufficient reason to deny Mr. Pitts' request, especially based on his conduct throughout the trial and his interaction with his prior attorneys. It wouldn't be unreasonable to infer that that same kind of conduct would happen should he be reappointed an attorney at this phase. And in fact, when he was appointed a fifth attorney for appeal, he fired that attorney.
What should we make of the fact that the court didn't articulate that reason? And we don't have the benefit of the court having sat through the trial. In fact, the court doesn't say that.
I think this court has the power to affirm the conviction or affirm the circuit court's decision based on other circumstances in the record.
But that's a very fact-based inquiry. In other words, kind of the pitch there would be if Judge Kim had articulated a very detailed, you know, I've been throughout this whole trial, I've watched you, I've interacted with you, I've seen you and your four lawyers, I think you've been playing the court, I think you're way, you know, you're way less, you know this process, and you're, I'm not saying he did, I'm just saying, you know, I've seen you in many ways take advantage of the process, and I find that you are just taking advantage of the process here again today. Accordingly, I am not going to grant you counsel for the purpose of your motions. That would be one thing, but the court didn't say that.
And I understand what you're saying, and I want us to keep in mind that the court is kind of working in the dark here. It has no solid approach, or this court and the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't given the circuit court some kind of guidance in how to deal with this situation. And what he needs to articulate during trial in terms of his denial and his or granting of a motion.
And Ms. McCullough, sorry, are you finished?
Yes.
You concede that if this court find that there is error, that you are agreeable to remanding the case for a new lawyer with respect to post-trial motions and sentencing. Is that correct?
That would be under the Ninth Circuit approach. That is correct. Under the totality of circumstances approach, it appears that they apply a harmless standard. So it depends which approach I guess this court.
Your position would be the same under either test. And your brief ends by saying, if we remand, then you would want remand to be limited to post-trial motions and sentencing with respect to the appointment of a new lawyer.
Correct.
So why are you limiting that remand just to that? How do you differentiate any requests for a new attorney before a verdict?
Well, if we're using the Ninth Circuit approach, starts with the basis that post-trial, the defendant should get their attorney back should they request or revoke their waiver, unless there's sufficient reason. And so,
you had five factor tests out of Lawrence in California.
For the California approach mid-trial.
Okay, mid-trial. So,
yes.
So, are you saying those factors don't apply here mid-trial?
Well, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, they could now.
Okay. But you don't think there's enough error before verdict in order to justify appointing a new attorney with respect to the trial?
I don't think there's any error pre-verdict, no.
Okay.
Anything further? No, thank you. Mr. O'Grady, your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Justice, I would like to just address a couple of points that were raised during the government's argument.
Mr. O'Grady, sorry, but I just wanted to confirm a couple of things. One is that after Mr. Pitts expresses frustration and the court denied counsel, was there any other request for counsel up to the time of verdict from that point?
After the final colloquy where the references to the ODC were made?
Yes.
I do not remember any, Justice Sokova. I know that he was adamant at that particular time that he wanted an attorney, and because of the complications regarding ODC, I think at that point he had not requested it again, but he was quite persistent at that time. I do not remember anything occurring after that point and until the verdict was read. Justice McKenna, you had raised a few questions with regard to the government as to whether or not Mr. Pitts' post-trial rights counsel were preserved, that is, after verdict and to sentencing and for the post-trial motions. It's Mr. Pitts' contention that, in fact, they were completely denied because he had no appointment to counsel, despite the fact that there were several requests made, as evidenced by the motions pointed out, Justice Pollack, and other items. If I can also point to Charles versus California, some of the language in there is instructive with regard to a governmental violation of a structural right that requires automatic reversal of the defendant's underlying conviction. And I think, as was brought up on the government's argument, it is the government's position that Judge Kim had basically interpreted Mr. Pitts' Feretta waiver to extend beyond verdict, and it is unclear from the record, as you point out, Mr. Chief Justice, exactly why Judge Kim determined that, and that it was to be turned back on at the appointment of appellate counsel. But there doesn't seem to be any facts that we can pull from the record as to why Judge Kim denied, despite Mr. Pitts' requests for a counsel, his right to counsel for the relevant time period as presented in the question here.
What about the government's suggestion that this court could look at the overall record and conclude that Judge Kim was relying or making some kind of a finding of bad faith on the part of the defendant due to the number of times he'd had counsel appointed and the nature of his interactions with those counsel?
It's Rogers versus Marshall, Mr. Chief Justice, that says that it is clearly established federal law that defendant's reassertion of the right to counsel of a separate post-trial proceeding cannot be denied simply on the grounds that the defendant has previously waived that right. And I think part and parcel of the analysis that carries over from the defendant's prior prior instances where he had waived counsel during trial, if you were then to carry that over to the next critical stage, which is post-trial, you're contaminating that analysis. And I think that case says that you cannot do that. You cannot base that on the prior waiver.
No, not the prior waiver, the prior instances of you know, repeated substitutions of counsel and the reasons that were given and the, you know, circumstances of each of them. So not so much not the fact that he had waived, but the fact that he had gone through four prior lawyers. And is that something that we can infer was going through Judge Kim's mind, or should infer?
Mr. Chief Justice, that's an excellent question. I believe that the court should approach making an inference like that with great caution, because we do not have a record from Judge Kim as to what he was, why he was doing what he was doing, that is, denying him that right during that relevant time period. The best that we have, as pointed from the quotes from you, Justice Pollack, and from you, Mr. Chief Justice, is that Judge Kim just said, no, you're not getting one now. We're not really clear why. I think it would be very dangerous to infer that this particular defendant or any particular defendant's prior actions, that they should be carried over into the new analysis. If it is If it is not that the Feretta waiver carries over, but let's take a look at what his prior actions were, that he's burned through four or five prior counsel, et cetera, while that might have provided the court with some background, should it have given this court a factual basis for its reasoning, then we could make that determination of whether or not it was proper for the court to have considered his prior actions.
He had never before been without counsel, correct?
Only during those time periods where he was getting reappointed new counsel, yes.
So he really had not had an opportunity to learn that even if he'd had difficulties with counsel, that it's certainly a lot worse to be without counsel. In fact, Judge Kim told him when he waived, "You're not a trained attorney, and I think you're making a big mistake." And apparently Mr. Pitts realized that.
Yes, and that is true. And as pointed out in the supplemental brief by Mr. Pitts, one of the things that he complained of was getting a transcript and some other items. And I believe during the initial colloquy during trial, Judge Kim had indicated that he would have difficulty subpoenaing witnesses. And so as pointed out in our brief, we said now Pitts was without counsel, naked, and was suffering from the exact sort of logistical problems that Judge Kim had cautioned him about. Judge Kim did not conduct a separate analysis to determine whether or not post-verdict the waiver should apply, and that is what should have occurred. He knew that at the time approaching verdict that Mr. Pitts had requested counsel, and shortly after the verdict, there's either oral and or written requests for counsel, yet Judge Kim, without a sufficient factual basis for this court to divine why it was denied, denying his counsel that fundamental structural right that is so basic for the relevant time period as presented in the question here today.
Mr. O'Grady.
Yes.
First of all, with respect to the Rogers versus Marshall, the Ninth Circuit saying that it was clearly established federal law, the United States Supreme Court did hold that that was error.
Yes.
And that the California standard could be followed by California and was actually properly applied by the California appellate courts. And so are you advocating adoption? The state says we should follow the California test for post-trial waiver issues. Is it your position that we should follow the California test, or the Ninth Circuit test, or some other test? And if so, why? Why should we adopt which test?
Yes, Ms. McKenna. An excellent question. It seems to me that if you approach a totality, well, the first test that I would advocate would be that under Chapman and Gonzalez, which is that the complete denial a fundamental right, such as the right to counsel, at a critical stage, which would include post-trial motions and sentencing, is such that it cannot be subject to a harmless analysis, and therefore it should just be reversed. The conviction should be reversed.
The conviction should be reversed?
Yes. I think that would be something that the
We're
court
discussing post-trial motions and sentencing. So you're saying based on the denial of the motion for new trial without counsel, the conviction should be reversed?
Well, If we send it back to resentencing, as this court has, while it might be the resentencing in this particular case, I think, although Justice Acoba, you point out that there could be changes made in the sentencing documents, where there is a mandatory sentence, and I'd like to answer your question, Justice McKenna, as I see my time.
You can go ahead and complete your answer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In the case where there is a mandatory sentence as imposed by statute, in order to provide under the Hawaii and I would think more so the Hawaii Constitution, which has extended the right to counsel to even the selection of private counsel, if this court was going to say that the right to counsel at a critical stage, including post-trial, is really a critical stage, then a message needs to be sent. If this court merely returns us to resentencing, and it's a mandatory sentence, then the legislature has, by putting in a mandatory sentence, effectively removed the right to counsel, because what would happen at a mandatory sentence?
You're arguing for a different test based on what the underlying conviction is?
Well, No, Justice Pollack. What I'm saying is that this court should not feel bound necessarily by the Ninth Circuit and should seek to protect the right to counsel at a critical stage, including post-trial, even if, in the case of a mandatory sentence, it can be argued that there might not have been much difference had counsel been present. That's what I'm attempting to
say. Okay, so you're not arguing that the conviction should be vacated. You're arguing the sentencing should be vacated.
Well, yes, if that's possible. I mean, I don't know how that is possible with a mandatory sentence for what he's been convicted of. So I'm leaving it to the court to adopt a new test. And Justice McKenna, with regard to which test to apply, the totality of the circumstances of the test would not be opposed necessarily by Mr. Pitts, because if it had been done by Judge Kim at the relevant time, that is, when his requests were made post-verdict, then we would have something to go off of. Because the government has argued that his prior instances of turning down counsel and such could have been considered. But again, I urge this court to exercise caution as to whether or not you're inferring from a very thin record as to the particulars of why Judge Kim did not appoint counsel during the time period as presented by the question that's here today for this court, which is post-verdict and up into the appointment of appellate counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I ask, inquire into one additional area of this?
Well, of course.
Mr. O'Grady, this has nothing to do with the supplemental briefing, but
yes,
it caused some concern. In your application, on page 10 to 11, you stated that here no witness testified that there was blood on Pitt's jacket. In fact, Pitt's got a government witness to admit that no blood of the complaining witness had been proven to be on Pitt's. And this, it appears that HPD criminalist Isaki had actually testified that he had extracted DNA from the blood on Mr. Pitt's jacket, compared it to the DNA reference sample from the victim, and confirmed that the blood on Pitt's jacket was identical match to Brown's. And so I'm wondering why this discrepancy in your statement as compared to what the evidence showed in this case.
I must fall on my sword at this time, Justice McKenna. In going over the documents, and it's no excuse, but there was quite a voluminous amount of documents, I discovered later that, in fact, I had missing transcripts that were scanned and did not get into my view until later. And I was proceeding off of a lot of the motion that Mr. Shum, Mr. Pitts had requested with regard to the potential extrajudicial examination of clothing regarding blood. I also honed in on the fact that Mr. Pitts argued that there was an insufficient amount of blood on him and in the cab of the vehicle, I'm sorry, as compared to the cab of the vehicle, because he said that there were such severe wounds to Mr. Brown's neck that it would not be conceivable that he did not have blood on him and such. He did make that argument. What I should have appropriately said, that there was an insufficient amount of blood, not that there was no blood. In examining the missing transcripts that I later discovered, I also think that there is one question that was posed by the prosecutor to Mr. Isaki, where he summed up that he had conducted an analysis and that DNA analysis was followed by a serology exam, and then he proceeded to type it. That one particular answer from Mr. Isaki can be read to establish that there was DNA and that the DNA came from blood, and I had not caught that, and I mistakenly focused on the fact that he was focusing on three blood-like drops on his jacket. What would have been more appropriate to have said was that there was an insufficient amount of DNA and or blood on Mr. Pitt's jacket or on his body as opposed to that. But that pertained to the issue raised by Mr. Pitts and Mr. Shum as to whether or not the jury had conducted an extrajudicial analysis of the jacket, and whether or not there was other blood there. But in examining Mr. Isaki's testimony, I think that sentence can be fairly read that, in fact, there was at least some evidence that one of the cuttings, one drop of blood, it was blood, and it was inappropriate and an error for me to have said that.
Thank you.
Yes. Are there any further questions, Mr. Chief Justice?
Any other questions from the court? Hearing none, thank you to counsel for your arguments this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.